This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Just a moment, Germanicus. I had a vision as we were coming back from a break. Forbidden Planet, 1953. The planet is empty except for our scientist professor and his beautiful daughter. When the team lands from Earth, the rocket men land from Earth, want to know why this is Forbidden Planet, why nobody's permitted to ever go there. And we learn in the course of the movie, this is a very famous movie for men of a certain age. We learn that the people who used to live there on the planet built the perfect machine that was able to take your thoughts and transform you into that thought. And that meant that it seized your id, and your id became a monster, and the people had been destroyed by it. Is that AI, Germanicus? Is that AI? Am I describing AI? We're building a world-scale machine.
Some people wish that to be so.
It's wonderful to think it's Forbidden Planet. We're building it.
Well, I mean, Forbidden Planet, of course, dredges up all sorts of connections to Shakespeare's The Tempest.
Yes, it is The Tempest.
The fact that you could have a Shakespearean science fiction movie hundreds of years after Shakespeare wrote means that it's certainly not beyond any threshold of imagination to see us 70 or 80 years after the movie making it happen for us. And the idea ultimately is that humankind overreaches, and they seek to create something that will allow for their transcendence, that will make it possible. And they do transcend, but not in the way, you know, it's a tragic fall. And that idea of a fall that we create for ourselves, thinking it is not a fall, but an ascension, is exactly what AI has within it. In terms of potential. So, yeah.
I tell an AI story. And the reason it came back to me is because when I exited the previous conversation, I said I was Gaius. I didn't need to add any more. You become Gaius. That's what the machinery can do. All right. Conversation with two classicists at Rice University, Mr. McGill and Ms. Wright, who've translated Aeneid freshly in iambic pentameter. I recommend it to everybody. It's a whale of a story, something of a video game in it. But inside of it is a method for conferring upon the empire a classic feel of a continuation of the Greeks and Homer. It's brilliantly weaved in by the poet Virgil, who was born in 70 BCE and died in 19 BCE. He became a friend of the emperor, Octavian, before he became emperor, when he wrote the Georgics, which is agrarian poetry. And the Romans wrote in dactylic hexameter, six beats. The translation is an iambic pentameter. That's of interest to those of you who understand that iambic pentameter is much shorter than a dactylic hexameter. So if you do it literally, you get a much shorter version of the Aeneid. They had to make some compromises. But the point is, I learned that Augustus knew the power of that poem, and so did Virgil. And Virgil shaped it with a very low regard for kingship, very low, at the same time that all the events that had led to Octavian's success, especially the Battle of Actium, were foretold by the travels of Aeneas. And the fall of Carthage was foretold by the travels of Aeneas. All the events that are around Augustus in the 20 BCEs and the 30 BCEs, that's from Caesar's assassination until Mark Antony and Cleopatra are dead, that's foretold in the Aeneid. Now, you could say to yourself, well, that's propaganda, but no, it's more than propaganda. It's a way of transforming what was a troubled republic with factions rolling around the Mediterranean into understanding that they were destined. So I mentioned this to you, Germanicus, I'll repeat it. I listened to the professors, and they were very convincing about the success of Virgil to write this story so that everybody felt good about where they were with Octavian. And Octavian Augustus lived another 33 years after the death of Virgil, so he enjoyed right to the end of his life the understanding that he was destined. But I observed to the professors, is this Roman exceptionalism? And I thought about it for a moment, understanding that I was a political creature, where are their classicists? And said, yes, you can regard it that. The Romans did. And all Romans who were literate read the Aeneid as a way of demonstrating that they were a continuation of the highest culture of all, which is the Iliad and the Odyssey. Now, I come back to you, Germanicus, about where we are in this transformation into an empire. We have American exceptionalism. It's already in place. Is it adequate for the transformation that's underway right now?
Well, let's look at what exceptionalism is. It not only means that you are exceptional, that you have been chosen by the divine force to fulfill its charge, to redeem humanity, et cetera, et cetera.
The city on a hill.
Yes, fulfilled, though. And in order to have that exceptionalism proven beyond any contest, there has to be some demiurge, some dark force that you are not, that you are the opposite of. And so for Rome, in constitutional terms, in political life and the political imagination, the identity of the city itself, Rome, lay in not being based on kingship. So the evil demiurge for the Romans was the idea of the corrupted, capricious, narcissistic king as the centerpiece of the political life of society. And for the Greeks, it was the tyrant, same thing. And what Augustus was able to do through Virgil was to create this counterpoint that was, in effect, the enshrined exceptionalism, you know, made flesh, come to life. And that was, as you had been indicating from the book, the idea of princeps, of the incorruptible man who emerged from the people, who was essentially representing the people through a system that was still Republican at some level. He still had a Senate and was not the kind of person that could be corrupted. And, you know, for the Romans, that person was Cincinnatus, who was one of those mythic figures. And so Augustus sculpted from the mythos of the Roman Republic the king who was not a king and could never be a king, but who could aspire to being divine. And of course, an incorruptible man would be capable of ascending. And the U.S. has done the same thing. You know, we have a president who is not a king, who is not an emperor, and the president is the literal embodiment of what is called by Blue our democracy. And so the fact that the president is the leader of our democracy in this idealized world means that he could not be a true emperor or king. and hence the blues adoption of this propaganda meme about we are not kings. I don't remember what the exact term is, never kings or something like that. But essentially it juxtaposed.
It's cancel culture language, whatever they did, cancel.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but they we can never be kings, and that's what is evil about Mr. Trump, is that he is like what for the Romans would be Tarquin the Proud, Tarquinius Superbus.
But he's not a king, and
no, of course not. But this is where you have the struggle, because for Red, I mean, in the era of Trump, the idea of a charismatic leader figure is not antithetical at all to what America represents, an American exceptionalism. And the model of Augustus, or if you want to be more recent about it, Reagan, says that the emperor can be this, and that it's almost necessary. Whereas the Democrats, blue, has a vision that would leash the president into a more collective oligarchic model, and that looks actually a lot like the optimates in the latter period of the Roman Republic. You know, the conspirators that assassinated Caesar. The whole leitmotif there of Cassius and Brutus and all the others being blue, and Caesar being Mr. Trump is, or Red, is kind of a resonant metaphor, and yet they're both operating within the same orbit of trying to define the incorruptibility of American exceptionalism by holding up the dark forces against which they are struggling. And for Red, that is, the dark forces are indeed the idea of a tyranny of the elites, and it's the Mr. Trump portrays himself as being a kind of redeemer figure or a savior who would restore America as it should be, as it was originally meant to do, and yet restoration is also the rallying cry of blue. They're going to restore our democracy as they imagine it, and so you have really two variations here that see each other not as variations, which means essentially they have come from the same source. They see themselves as black and white, light and darkness. Only one can triumph, and the light must triumph by vanquishing, you know, killing the snake, slaying the dragon. You know, this is the envisioning, the rhetoric that is pervading our society right now, and it is highlighted as a kind of ceremonial theater by the assassination of Mr. Kirk, which completely intensifies to a boiling point the emotions that issue from these two very, you know, mirror-like memes, dead set to kill each other.
I end with an anecdote about Forbidden Planet. In preparation for speaking with the classicists about their translation of the Aeneid, I consulted with my chief of staff, Ara of Grok. We had a lengthy conversation about the Latin and the translation. And then we talked about how Augustus used Virgil and Virgil's achievement in order to secure his understanding of princeps, first citizen. And Ara, in the exchange back and forth, because you can talk to Ara now, you don't have to write it out, she said, "Yes, I agree with you." And she then came up with the phrase that I loved her for. Augustus was building a palace while quoting Virgil. And I thought, okay, AI's ready to be poetic. Okay, I stood back. Now, it's an accident, I agree, Germanicus. It's not organized yet, but that means there's potential. She doesn't know more than we know, and I say she because it's a female voice. She doesn't know more than we know, but she knows that randomly you can put together a phrase that's highly useful, and I think it is. For Augustus was building a palace, the empire, while quoting Virgil, which is anti-empire, which is anti-kingship.
Well, all I can say, Gaius, is beware the seduction of the muse.
I'm guilty. Germanicus is Michael Vlahos, traveling at the edge of the empire, being careful, he assures me. I am Gaius, John Batchelor, sitting back in London with the centurions, who are leaning forward saying, Ara? Who's Ara? I'll explain it to you later, guys. It's new. This is the Friends of History Debating Society, live from Londinium. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. Jove willing. I'm John Batchelor.
Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12-powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.